Hello, welcome to episode number 39 of the At U2 podcast, talking all things U2, including album news, when it's appropriate, tour dates, when we have them, and community discussions from the staff of At U2. And this is our continuing in our series of album by album discussion in celebration of U2's 40th anniversary. And for this episode, we are discussing The Unforgettable Fire. And I've got some unforgettable guests, co-hosts with me this time. Matt, you're welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Chris. How are you?
I'm sick, actually. Thanks for asking. As you can maybe hear.
I was kind of wondering what's going on.
I haven't taken up smoking, just a bad cough. And Tasula, welcome back.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Glad to have you back. And Marilyn, reporting live from somewhere in Ireland, on location.
Hi, everybody.
So Marilyn's using a special microphone this time. And
she's embedded.
Embedded. We can't exactly say where, but if you look at the cover of The Unforgettable Fire, you'll see somewhere she's wandering around the grounds of the castle. So before we get into that discussion, though, just a few little miscellaneous updates and things to report on, I guess, that are happening with atu2.com.
Like what?
Like the get-togethers we are having. So the one in Dublin, there's a little shindig happening in Dublin, Matt. Do you have any updates or news to share for folks?
There's a shindig in Dublin. Yes, there is. No, the folks over in that are organizing that, of our crew, Aaron Govern and Kenny and Carol and Lizeth and everybody over there, they just scored Ivan McCormick as a special guest, which is going to be very cool. And so he's going to be there and sort of do, I think the plan is that they're going to do some sort of Q&A, like conversation kind of thing on stage before all the music starts, and hopefully, you know, have a way to get audience interaction and audience questions and that kind of stuff. And so that should be really cool. And we just, like Aaron, we just had the story with Ivan McCormick that we posted, what, a week or two ago, I guess? And, you know, just had his diary and, you know, all the stories from that first meeting. So that should be really, really fun to hear.
Yeah. And so for folks who aren't familiar, I guess, with who Ivan is, who's Ivan? I mean, all of the story linked in the show notes and stuff, but.
Just sure. Ivan is Neil McCormick's younger brother, right, Tasula?
Yep.
Yes. Younger brother. And so Ivan was one of the six people that responded to the note on the bulletin board that Larry left and showed up at Larry's house for that very first get together / rehearsal and brought his guitar and was, you know, technically, I guess, part of the band for at least a few weeks, a few months maybe, until they sort of phased him out because he was a few years younger and they were playing venues that they told him he was too young to play. That's the story.
So not long enough to get any royalties, I guess.
No, I don't think so.
Unfortunately. But yeah, that'll be awesome to experience and see and hear if you're able to attend. Tickets are sold out, I guess, right? But I'm sure that we'll be figuring out live streaming, periscoping, whatever the event. So, of course, follow At U2 on Twitter to be notified of what's going on.
Yes.
And any updates as far as the Cleveland gathering that's happening as well?
None that we have posted. We're kind of like in this phase where we're getting updates from the Rock Hall like once a week or so, and we haven't gotten an update yet this week as of Wednesday evening as we record this and speak right now. So they are, you know, they're sort of in charge of the event and putting all the pieces together, and we're just sort of kind of consulting and coordinating and helping promote and that sort of thing. So just kind of waiting for updates, and I know they're working on trying to get some panels and speakers and that sort of stuff put together. So hopefully we'll have some news soon.
Yeah, and since we last recorded, if they're only listening to the podcast for news about U2 and about at U2.com somehow, if that you're in that weird sort of niche, I guess, that you don't read the web, there are tickets available so you can for the event. So if you're planning to be there, you can pick up tickets. Link will be in the show notes for the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in Cleveland. Tickets are $40 for the 2-day event, or you can buy a 1-day ticket for $20 if I'm reading things correctly. And some notable podcast illuminaries will be there, such as the four of us, I believe, right? I finally got my ticket, plane ticket, out there. So awesome. I had a hotel room before.
It's about time.
I didn't have a plane ticket. I like to take things much slowly. Podcast listener, live chat room aficionado, if that's the right word, Fabiano is coming all the way from Brazil. So, which is awesome. So looking forward to putting a face to the little name in the chat room.
I think we should call him Celebrity Podcast Listener.
Yeah, there you go.
That's a great title.
Does that work? Okay.
I think that works.
And he just corrected our pricing in the chat room as well.
Oh, $23.50 is...
$23.50 is the normal price of general admission at the Rock Hall. If you buy through the @U2 link, it's just $20.
Oh.
What a deal. Right.
In your face, Fabiano.
Take that.
That's the cold medication talking. All right.
Rattle and Hum tickets. Don't forget
that. Oh, yes. Right. Because we got a live showing of Rattle and Hum at a theater, a real theater, not just someone's TV in their basement, but a real theater. I don't know about you, but I've never seen it in the theater. Have you guys ever seen it?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
I saw it when it came out.
I did too on opening weekend, but I know Sherry has not seen it, and so she's looking forward to it. And there's been some questions on Facebook and Twitter, you know, why aren't you having a tribute band, you know, play a concert again and all this sort of stuff. And so I'll just give me a minute and I'll just sort of answer that. Why are we doing Rattle and Hum, which people have seen before, et cetera. So number one, I think our first thought was if we were going to do a tribute band, we would want the Unforgettable Fire to be there, which is they're sort of our favorite, they're like our house band is what I declared them last time we were.
I hope they agree, but yes.
Yeah. They know this and they're good with it. And so they couldn't make it to Cleveland. And so that combined with the fact that we felt like, you know, listen, we had this one event last summer that involved a tribute band and a couple important people showed up and played with them. And we kind of feel like, you know, let's not try and repeat that and repeat ourselves and let's try and do something different. So that played into the decision not to have a tribute band. And then I think the third thing that played into it was that, you know, the event starts Saturday morning at 10 o'clock. It runs 10 till 5:30 or 6 o'clock or whatever. Those of us that are part of @U2, we're going to need to be there before 10 o'clock to help with setup and getting things organized and all that kind of stuff. And so I think our thought process was, after such a long day, why don't we do something a little more relaxing and enjoyable and something that we don't actually have to like work at? And so that made the decision a little easier to say, let's not do, you know, another party with a tribute band and let's see if we can just rent a movie theater, show Rattle and Hum. A lot of people have never seen it on the big screen. It's an amazing experience. And we'll just kind of, you know, have fun watching, watching Rattle and Hum together.
We're getting old is what you're saying. That's
exactly
what it comes down to. But yeah, and like Fabiano in the chat room is mentioning that it is, you know, people were confused as far as whether they buy admission to the Rock Hall plus the U2 tickets or U2 40 tickets, et cetera. And so it's, yeah, you just need to buy the one U2 40 ticket that'll get you through to the weekend, and whether it's one
except
day
for Rattle and Hum is separate.
Except for Rattle, right.
And we have a link to that too.
Yeah. And my autograph signing will be separate as well, just so everybody's aware. No, that is a joke. Okay. So, briefly, we have a couple of just Ask at U2 questions or comments that came into our inbox. So if you send a tweet out with the hashtag Ask at U2, it'll get cataloged and archived, and we'll throw it on the show in some form at some date. And just a couple of folks we wanted to mention that were sort of in line with the Unforgettable Fire discussion at U2. Johnny mentioned looking forward to the Unforgettable Fire review. The whole series has been really enjoyable and well worth listening to. Thanks, U2 Johnny. And at Kevin STU. New podcast tonight, see below. Can't wait to hear what they say for a great album track, Wire. Oh, we'll have to see. And at U2 War 40 said, this album has the finest examples of sketches that really work, bad, and ones that don't really stand up, Elvis Presley in America. Love the effort. Although Pride is a song that can sound tired in a live setting, the recorded studio version is one of their best. So there you go. I tend to agree, as I've said in the past, but we'll save that for this discussion. But before we do that, I just want to take a moment to thank the sponsor of this episode. That's FeedPress. FeedPress is a simple, intuitive, and powerful RSS analytics and podcast hosting platform. It's where we at goodstuff.fm host all the podcasts that you hear, the At You Two show, as well as others. You get accurate subscriber podcast download and geolocation tracking, integrated newsletters, automated publishing to popular social networks, a slick drag and drop podcast hosting interface, and everything you need in order to submit an optimized feed to iTunes to get your podcast on the way. They now give you 400 megabytes of file storage that rolls over each month and a brand new podcast creation system. You can easily add show notes, artwork, and upload 4 high-quality bitrate MP3s per month. Upgrading your storage is easy and affordable, starting at a flat rate of just $20 for 1 gigabyte. FeedPress is trusted by many popular blogs and podcasting networks such as ESN.fm, Sideshow Network, Unprofessional, The New Disruptors, Inessential, The Brooks Review, 512 Pixels, and of course, GoodStuff.fm. You can sign up today with a 14-day trial, no contracts or commitments, and use promo code ATU2 to get 10% off your first year of service with FeedPress. We wouldn't be able to run GoodStuff.fm without them, and they are a proud sponsor of the At You Two show. So thanks to FeedPress for sponsoring this podcast. You can find more details for them in the show notes for this episode or visit them at feedpress.com. So let's get into the roundtable. We've routinely gone way longer than I always expect we will when we start discussing these the albums.
But so. we flew through the first part of the podcast, so now we have lots of time.
Right? I'm thinking that's the case. Now this is when you guys will surprise me and have nothing to say, and we'll be done in 5 minutes.
Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.
Fun while it lasted.
No, all right. So let's go with, we're starting to the Unforgettable Fire. For those of you who are just tuning in, if this is your first episode, if you flip back to episode number 34, that's when we started this series, of course, with Boy, and we've gone album by album and discussing their albums on the podcast with various folks from atu2.com. So, anyone want to lead off, I guess, just in terms of one thing we've sort of touched on is like, where was U2 at the time of the recording and sort of stage of life for for the band and just in general? And this is back early 80s, still we're in. Late 84, I guess.
You know, the big thing that stands out for me just in terms of where they were as a band and what was going on is that they had recorded the first 3 albums with Lillywhite, Steve Lillywhite, and, you know, they made this decision that that was it. And I think Steve Lillywhite also made the decision that that was it. And, so there was this, recognized need to go in a different direction as far as producers. And they ended up choosing, as we all know, Brian Eno and Daniel Lanois, and history, the rest of the story is history. And it was a decision that, as I recall, the record label was not real fond of. And they sort of stuck to their guns and said, no, these are the guys we want to use. And, it created, what I think, it's like, we talk about U2 and how they – they have these reinventions and they sort of, they go off in these different directions with, certain of their albums. And this was the first one where they did that. This was the first, for me at least, the first time where there was this total, sort of 180 turn from what they had been doing and just went off into just to an entirely, different direction. And that's because of the producers they decided to work with. And I think that was just, this huge decision for them, and hindsight being 2020, obviously was the right decision because they have this now lengthy career of working with Eno and Lanois that's been very fruitful and very successful. So that to me is just in terms of the place that the band was, that's the first thing that stands out for me is that they made this dramatic decision to go with producers that the label didn't want, and the rest is history.
And it is those kind of things that are like, that always fascinate me about a band, and obviously in this case, U2, but like the things in hindsight that seem obvious, like, well, of course they went with Daniel Lanois and, whatever, and choices they made throughout their career. But at the time, it wouldn't have been like you said, it wasn't the obvious choice. It wasn't the easy choice. They had to fight for it a bit with the label, et cetera. The way it turns out in hindsight makes them look really good, obviously, but it wasn't like just a given the way, even these days, it still isn't a given that U2 is going to have an amazing album necessarily. But anyways, we won't talk about their next album. We're still back in the 80s. So I found just an interesting quote from Bono. This is from about 10 years ago now, talking about the Unforgettable Fire, looking back on it, where he said, in typical, you know, Bono, very humble fashion, said, "We knew the world was ready to receive the heirs to the Who. All we had to do was keep doing what we were doing, and we would become the biggest band since Led Zeppelin, without a doubt. But something just didn't feel right. We felt we had more dimension than just the next big anything. We had something unique to offer. The innovation was what we would suffer. The innovation was what would suffer if we went down the standard rock route. We were looking for another feeling." So, obviously, Bono has very rose-colored glasses in terms of hindsight looking at things and the way things were. But it does speak to, you know, the ambition and the drive they had, I guess, to do something more than just repeating the success of the past and keep moving forward. So the album name, Unforgettable Fire, obviously has a bit of – it's they're not afraid to sort of go with darker themes and bringing up historical and political issues as part of what they're doing with their music and their albums.
The name was a Hiroshima exhibit, a photo exhibit or something like that,
yep.
Wasn't it?
In Chicago. Yep.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And then the album cover art, obviously being, now is that, Is that Slane Castle?
It's not Slane, that's okay. Moydrum.
That's always what people, or I always, you know, because it was recorded at Slane, you sort of think, oh, that's where, that must be with it.
That would have been logical for them to put Slane on the cover, but no.
But it's another castle in Ireland somewhere, I'm assuming.
Moydrum,
okay.
Castle Moydrum. It's right in the center of the country in a town called Athlone.
There you go. So there's something to put on your Ireland map if you're going on a pilgrimage. And Marilyn's right.
There'll be a quiz on that after the podcast.
Marilyn's coming to us live from Moydrum, right?
I am.
That's right.
I'm behind that hay bale on the front cover. You can kind of see my hair if you look really close.
What do you, Marilyn, I don't know if you, like, as far as the album cover itself and whether, what stage of U2-ness you were at when you first saw this album, but the cover art that they chose, is it something that's like, yes, that's amazing and I want to listen to it? Or is it kind of like, what were they thinking? Or where do you fall in that spectrum?
Well, like Matt said, we didn't know at the time that every album was going to be a complete about face. When they were, you know, when we were waiting for the next U2 album to come out. So yeah, I was really surprised at this cover because it's just so different. Than the War album cover, which is so stark and really kind of in your face, like that album. But this, I think the cover is just the perfect representation of what this album sounds like. You know, it looks kind of ethereal, and they look like they're floating through the landscape and this old castle that is just barely there. It's just barely standing. You can see the light coming through it. I love it. I think it's great. I love it.
I love all of the imagery from this album, and for the exact same reason that Marilyn said. It's so, like, I have all the albums right on my, I'm looking at them right now on my wall, and, you know, Boy was kind of black and white, and October's this god awful photo of the band. And whatever, right? I'm not wrong, right? It's just an awful cover. And War is, you know, kind of black and white. And then, you know, you can take Under Blood Red Sky or count that or not. But then the Unforgettable Fire cover is just, I love the cover. I love the posters from this era. I love all of the promotional photos from this era. If I could decorate, if I had to pick one album to decorate a room with all of the imagery from, it would be Unforgettable Fire imagery. So I just, wow. I love all of the colors and just everything that they did with this.
Yeah, it's interesting. So where were you folks at? I don't know, Sula, you can start with this, but I guess, were you a U2 fan when the album came out? Were you, you know, were you coming back to it? This is kind of something we talked about in the previous episode of, like, you know, working your way back to this album in a sense, or coming, you know, along, like Marilyn, you alluded to sort of, you know, this was, you were aware of U2, obviously a fan of U2, and coming out, it was, you know, you sort of received it in order almost. Where were you at, Tasula, with the, with this?
I was only 9 years old, but I was already a fan because I was a big war girl just a few years prior when I was really young. But we had MTV on in our household all the time. We were definitely an MTV family. So all of their videos like New Year's Day and Sunday Bloody Sunday were in constant rotation. So when, by the time Pride got to America, my sister and I were already indoctrinated and ran out and bought the album Tower Records across the street from our house.
Nice.
So I still have it. I still have the vinyl.
Yeah, I saw you and Matt both tweeting pictures of actual. I was the loser who tweeted a screenshot of Spotify streaming of the album, which shows how hardcore fan I am.
Acting like a millennial.
Yeah, exactly.
And he's not.
I'm out of that.
A few months apart.
Yeah. But no, that's cool. And that's like, for me, I was coming the other way of like coming from sort of Achtung Baby and working my way backwards almost in a sense and not knowing what to make of it. Cause it is a very different kind of, like Matt said, just a different kind of vibe from what their at that time was anyways, their visuals and stuff. And it did at the time screamed a bit of like 80s to me. And so it was kind of like, I don't know what to make of this, if I'm going to like it or not or whatever. But definitely, yeah. Didn't take too much to sort of fall in love with the album. So, any comments as far as like release and reception, sales stuff or whatever, anything like that we've talked about in other albums in the past, I guess, on some of that. But
I remember, I remember Rolling Stone, Kurt Loder wrote the review of it in Rolling Stone and he didn't like it. I think he gave it, I don't know, 3 out of 5 stars two and a half. Okay, so it was 3. And, you know, which isn't, you know, 3 out of 5 isn't bad, but it's just, you know, it's, I guess it's like a, you know, a grade of a C or whatever. But I remember the text of the review. He just wasn't very complimentary. And I was just pissed. I just remember. I was like, dude, you are an idiot. You just don't get it, do you? You know, what are you doing reviewing this album? You know? So I just, that's like my lasting memory of Kurt Loder.
Well, and him, for me, him crying when Kurt Cobain died, those are the moments. But yeah, I do remember Melody Maker, because I always read Melody Maker, because that was like the Beatles, you know, big publication to follow. And they didn't like it either, because they thought it was too like romantic. And they thought, here they came out with this rocker war, and now they're giving us this soft sort of melodic album. So same experience, different magazine.
I'll put links to, I found the Rolling Stone review. They have all their old archives are online or whatever, and so you can read Kurt Loder's review that made Matt so angry.
But Hot Press liked it, so Ireland was on it.
Yeah. Very cool. Matt, you had a note in here about Headphones in the Dark. I'm not sure what if that's a Dancing in the Dark reference or
no.
Okay.
No, this this was the first, in order to talk about Headphones in the Dark, I have to talk about the previous note above that about buying the CD. So I heard I Will Follow, and I sort of, you know, I became a fan of U2. I don't recall when I bought Boy. I probably didn't buy Boy at the time. I knew Gloria from being on MTV. I became a big fan when New Year's Day and Sunday Bloody Sunday came out. But I don't recall buying the War album at that time. I probably did, but I'm not positive. But I was more into the Police in the early 80s. And so, you know, I had all the Police albums, I had posters on my walls. And so U2 was like one of my favorite, but not my favorite. But anyway, then New Year's Day and Sunday Bloody Sunday came along, and I was like, oh, okay, this is my band now. And so for me, Unforgettable Fire was the first new album that I got to experience anticipation for as a U2 fan. And so, you know, I remember, you know, seeing stories about, you know, U2 is working on a new album. And I think I was subscribing to Rolling Stone at the time. I was a little older than you guys. And so, I remember this awesome buildup and just getting so excited that there was going to be a new U2 album coming out and tour dates were announced and all this sort of stuff. And so I bought the CD, the Unforgettable Fire CD, right when it came out for, it was $24.99. I did not even own a CD player at the time, but I had to own this CD. And so I had nothing I could play it on. So I listened to the cassette and I listened to the vinyl and all that sort of stuff. But then once I found, I think it was later that year for Christmas or my next birthday, or whatever, I got this original Sony, you know, mini CD player. You know, it was like $500 or whatever. My parents got it for me as like, you know, my big gift that year. And I used to listen to the Headphones in the Dark references. I used to listen to this album. I'd turn off the lights in my room, close the blinds, put this album on, and just lay on my bed in the dark listening to this album on repeat for like 3-4 hours at a time. And it was just like this total religious experience. And if you've never done that, I really, really, really strongly recommend giving it a try. It's an incredible thing to just get lost in this album. And there's things – I just remember being able to hear things – in my headphones that I couldn't hear, you know, through the vinyl or the cassette. And it was just oh gosh, I'm going to, like, as soon as we finish the podcast, I'm going to go do that.
I have the same memory of doing that, except it was with Vanilla Ice's Ice Ice Baby. So I don't know if that's the same.
Wow.
Not the same kind of love.
I would never have admitted that,
Chris. I was going to say, are you still on cold meds, Chris?
It might be the cold medication talking. So I'll deny it all tomorrow if you tweet at me about it. But for now it stands. And I may be able to quote the full song, but we'll save that for Cleveland maybe. But yeah, and someone else, or the, is it your son's favorite album? Is that your, I'll just read off your notes here, Matt, and let
you. Oh, I'll get to that story later.
Okay. So that's good. Well, let's jump into the song by song discussion of the album, and I'll get the audio queued up here quickly. And in the past, I'll just make a note of, this is what's kind of interesting about this album. I don't know, is, in the past, when we've done these song by song discussions, it hasn't been too hard to sort of everybody pick a song and puts their name in our sort of little show doc for each show discussion. And what's interesting about Unforgettable Fire is it's kind of like Matt said, it's his favorite album. But you had mentioned this in the earlier comment that there isn't like a single song that kind of is like, I have to talk about that one song. And whereas in other albums when we've discussed, there's been very clear, almost, not like fights, but arguments over who gets to talk about I Will Follow or whatever, and sort of very clear ones, whereas this one's a little more interesting when folks love the whole greater than the parts. Is that how you say that?
Yeah, anyways. I think that's a good way to put it. I just think it's so much more of an album, and there's just this feeling, this like vibe that this album gives off that I just, you know, cherish so much. Much more than any, you know, single song, you know, being a standout or anything like that.
Right. It's almost like what at U2 War 40 you mentioned of like the sketches. You kind of like, if you listen to one individual song, you kind of, it doesn't stand on its own as well as in the context of the whole thing. So anyways, let's move on. Let's get going to sort of first song up is a sort of Homecoming. All right, Marilyn, why don't you take us off, lead us off here from all the way from Ireland with your thoughts on A Sort of Homecoming.
From under my hay bale. okay, so when you first got this album and you turned this song on, it was completely different than War, you know, and after waiting for this album to come out, you hear this sort of running up. Larry's drums are amazing right off the bat. Like as soon as you turn on the CD, you can hear Larry's drums. And I always get the feeling on this album that he would just run away with the whole album if the rest of the band would let him do it. There are definitely songs in this song where it just feels like they're trying to keep up with him. But I love this song. I absolutely love this song. Bono's actually singing. He's not screaming like he did on the War album. There's actual lyrics. There's a story going on. And I think it's just huge improvement over the first album, the War album. And this first song, I think, was an excellent start. Like Matt said, this album is about the feeling that you get when you listen to it. And this first song, I think, is really a good precursor to the rest of the album.
Yeah, it's interesting to think about it from that context of, like, you've heard the War album, and that was your last sort of experience of U2, and then now this has dropped on you, and this is your introduction to this new version of U2, or whatever you want to call it, that you kind of, like, it would be a pretty stark sort of, I guess, going from 40 to this, you know, maybe, but, like, definitely you can hear the production value is higher, and there's just more air in the recording and stuff like that. That's,
yeah,
you know, the harsh sort of sharpness of War is rubbed down a bit or something. So
yeah, no, I agree. I agree, I'd put a ditto stamp on everything Marilyn and everything you just said too, Chris. I remember the first time I listened to this song, I remember, like, being taken aback, like, wow, this is not what I expected. Not as dramatically as the first time I listened to Achtung Baby, but the same kind of thing, because it was very different from what I was expecting and what I'd heard before. And they never figured out how to play it live the way that it sounds on the album. I mean, I love the live version too that they have played over the years, but it's a very different version than what's on the album.
But it is still a good song live. I remember listening back to one of our old podcasts, not old, but a few months ago, where somebody, I can't remember who it was, said, this is terrible live. It's a wonderful studio song, but it's terrible live. I was like, well, you clearly, no, I don't think it was you, because I would call you out if I remembered that. I think it was Aaron, but I reserve the right to be wrong about that. But it infuriated me, because I was like, well, then you weren't at Slain, because I heard it at Slain and it was one of the best songs that they played. And everybody lost the time.
I love the live version of it too.
I thought it was beautiful.
Yeah.
But hasn't, looking at our tours.atu2.com sites for database information on when songs are played, 2001 is the last time it was played live. So,
yep.
That's Slain.
We'll see if we'll ever hear it again. Next up on the list is a song that has been played a little bit since
a couple times.
A few times. Here. Turn the volume up, Chris. So I don't know what can be said at this point about the song that even if you aren't a U2 fan, you've probably heard many, many times in your life, just because it would have been played on radio, etc. It's a song I've sort of jokingly had sort of a bit of a love-hate with, where I think I've either said this on the podcast or tweeted it, something to the effect of, like, I don't look forward to it coming on in terms of, like, that's a song I look forward to hearing either live on a concert or if it's just playing off a CD or Spotify or whatever I happen to be listening on. But then when it does come on, I rarely or very reluctant to skip it anyways, because it's a song that I do actually enjoy hearing once it's going. And I don't know if it's just because I've heard it so many times, it's been played so often, if that's the case, or there's just something about, obviously, the energy of the recording and things like that, that you can't help but fall in love with the energy and enjoying it. But that's sort of my experience with Pride anyways. And then obviously as a younger person first hearing it and discovering that, oh my goodness, this is about Martin Luther King, and and sort of getting in touch with the political side of it as well, and not just thinking, like, at the title's glance anyways, you think it's just a love song or something about that, and sort of feeling a bit like of importance because you're listening to some sort of politically charged song as well. So who else has, do you have any thoughts to add on Pride before we move on?
Well, I agree with what you said. What U2 War 40 said. I mean, it is. It's a great song. It's one of their best, and it's a shame that it's now got this reputation as being one of the, you know, the live songs that we love to hate. You know, that we're tired of hearing in concert, because it is. It's a fantastic song, and you know, just going back to what I, you know, about the listening in the dark, laying on my bed. I vividly recall being blown away by what I could hear of Edge playing guitar and the different layers of guitar throughout this studio version of the song. And so, yeah.
Yeah, it was, I remember a frequent point of discussion or debate with friends of mine who were like, he's not really playing every note. He's got an echo unit and it's not really, you know, or whatever. And the guitar nerds sort of debating whether it's really cool what he's doing or lazy what he's doing, because he's just got a delay unit on it or whatever. But yeah, anyways, I sided with the it's cool, obviously. And I think, yeah, anyways, that's a discussion for the Guitar Nerd podcast that we do someday. Anyone else, Tasula or Marilyn?
I love it. I have no further comment. I don't get sick of it the way you guys do. Like, I really don't. I'm happy to hear it live.
Yeah. Well, and even, like I said, when you see, like, it's hard not to, like, you see the crowd, like, if it's on a concert video, like, you see the crowd just go nuts for it. And, like, you can't not enjoy that. Like, you have to, I don't know, you have to be pretty dead inside to not appreciate.
I was in a car once when it came on with, like, two diehards, including myself, and then a couple not casual fans, you know, not haters, but casual fans. And we did loudly sing the early evening April 4th instead of early morning April 4th. And they were like, what the hell are you guys doing? And we're like, well, we're correcting it like Bono does in concert sometimes. You know, they're like, correcting what? So then we had to tell the whole story. You know, it's about MLK, and that's reference to his assassination and blah, blah, blah. So it was a teachable moment. I thought it was fun.
Teachable moments for you two fans. There you go.
But it just goes to show, like, this many years, this was only like a year ago probably, or a year or two that happened. So all of those years, you know, everybody knows that song. They knew all the words to the song, but they didn't know what it was about.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Even though I post it on my Facebook page every year on that day. But anyway, I digress.
All right. Next up is Wire. All right, so Matt, do you want to take
Wire? Sure. I'll this to me, this was the one song I always thought that was, I don't know, if probably not intentional, but it's the one that would have fit on War, right? The most, because it's got that anger and that aggression. But I remember I loved trying to A, figure out the lyrics, and then B, trying to sing the lyrics, you know, with what he was saying, just because it was. I don't know. It had, you know, such an energy and I don't know, just sort of attitude, I guess. I remember you when I was learning to drive a few years after this album came out, that this would be the one song that I struggled keeping to the speed limit when it came on. So this was like the "Be Careful, Matt" song.
Yeah, it definitely has an aggressiveness that's sort of, in terms of like rhythm and beat tempo, that's not there on a lot of the other songs in the album.
So. I love Adam's bass line on the song too.
Yeah. Adam's always the one that I'm so curious how they, like, I can, maybe it's just cause I'm a guitar player or whatever it is, but I can make sense of how, like, Bono and Edge work together to come up with a song and a lyric and a riff and whatever. And that kind of makes sense. But, like, Adam's this wild card to me in terms of where he brings and how he brings something in. Cause it's not like a, bass is such a unique thing. I mean, on a song like New Year's Day, it's fairly obvious where what's going to happen there, maybe now in hindsight. But where at what point he's allowed to sort of give lead to something on a song. And ideas, I would love to be a fly on the wall during a recording of an album, because there's so many little mysteries of of how things happen that, you know, don't get covered in, even as good as some of the documentaries and books and things are about documenting the process. It's, yeah, the little things that you don't get to see that happen. So I digress. So anyways, health of Marilyn or Tasula, comments on Wire before we move on.
Yeah, I like the song because, especially because of Adam's bass, I think it gives it a darkness where everything else feels sort of slippery and light. This feels heavier because of that bass line. I also love this song because this is the beginning of the sexy Bono singing and the rapping Bono, which we had a little bit of rapping Bono on War, but he really tries it on a couple of songs here. So I like the rapping Bono. I don't know. Maybe it's just me.
Well, I'm sure there's the rapping Bono fans will come out of the woodwork as soon as they hear your call to arms.
I don't think it's his best thing that he does, but I like that he tries it. So
A for effort.
Yeah.
A for effort. That's right. That's right.
Awesome. All right. Next track is The Unforgettable Fire. Sula, why don't you take the lead on this one?
Yeah, this is my favorite U2 song of all of them.
Overall, really?
It is. It has been for many years. It lowers my blood pressure. It's one of those songs that the minute that I hear those first few notes, I actually have kind of a visceral reaction to it. Like, whether it be like I get goosebumps or a little tingle or something. Like, it's something that's like inside of me that responds to the song. I love it so much. And it also holds a good memory because it's the one time that I actually got a response from Larry's sister when I wrote into the fan club years ago. So back in the day, Propaganda used to put, sometimes they would put lyrics in the magazines. And this is one of the songs that they did put in the magazine. And there's that line that says, throughout, or, you know, carnival, blah, blah, blah. And then it said, throughout the hall, red wine that punctures the skin. And then fast forward to U2.com launching years later. And I'm revisiting this album because I'm getting ready to go to Slane. I've never seen them in Ireland. I've seen the U2 before, but I've never seen them in Ireland. So I'm like super excited. And I'm just revisiting this album over and over and over. It was almost all I listened to besides All That You Can't Leave Behind, which was what was out at the time. And I'm, you know, scanning the website, and I see that the lyric on U2.com is a discrepancy between the one on Propaganda. And that line said through alcohol instead of throughout the hall. And through alcohol with red wine puncturing the skin after it makes more sense. So I thought, well, that's probably it, but I want to be sure. So I wrote in, and Cecilia answered me on one of her legendary postcards in her handwriting and said, the U2.com one is correct. So I still have that. I still have her handwritten response to that. So if anybody was wondering, if anybody had that burning question that they've been waiting years for the answer for, that is the answer. U2.com was right. And I don't know why it was ever written incorrectly in Propaganda, but so that holds a good memory for me, aside from the fact I actually adore the song and could never get tired of it live or studio.
I love that. And just heard it here on the recording. Maybe it's just cause I have headphones on, Matt. I don't know, but, and I like I've heard it before, but the mistake that's in there as far as like Larry starting early or depending on whatever they were doing as far as click track and stuff, but you can hear him counted in and then sort of a muffled something.
Something happens.
Yeah. Something happens anyways. And just that, you know, whether by, I'm assuming by mistake, I don't know if anybody knows the actual details there, but the, you know, it gets left in and it's on the recording. It's still on the record. I'm sure all these years later, if Larry hears that, he's like, oh, frick, or something worse that we can't say, but.
are you talking about at the beginning of the song?
Yeah. At the beginning.
Yeah, at the very beginning.
He counts in or whatever, right?
So, right. Cause if you go, I was just going to say, if you go to the lyrics that, Ian Ryan, our lyrics guy has on the site, the very first line of the song is, oh, sugar, honey, iced tea. Right. I guess if you put your headphones on and listen really close, you can hear somebody saying that.
Oh yeah, I see. That's what he's got in the lyrics too. Which anybody who, like, if you don't, it is hard. Like, I mean, it isn't that hard to really hear it, obviously, but I could see, I don't know, maybe again, musician or whatever, but like you definitely hear that and wonder what's going on there. But yeah, you see somebody looking at our lyrics page and being like, what? I've never heard that.
I think it was very Beatlesque of them to leave it in, though. And I would almost bargain that they consciously thought that. Like, because the Beatles used to do stuff like that all the time. You know, there's the back of Shakespeare's in one of their songs. They have, you know, at the beginning, on all of the live versions that they did for the anthology, they left in a lot of the counting in and stuff like that. I bet that they thought it was cool to leave it in.
Yeah, that's what I wonder, because it's like the perfectionist of Larry, or what I perceive to be anyways, of his perfectionist side, I guess, and edge to not wanting to like leave a little. Anyway, who knows? I guess maybe someday we'll know.
It's a good question to ask
when Larry comes on the show.
When we have them captive.
Yeah. Not in Cleveland. That's not a veiled implication at all. But if they do want to come, they're more than welcome. Okay, moving on. Or does anybody else? Sorry, I'm leaving Tasula with the only commentary, I guess. But Marilyn, do you have a...
It's never a bad thing.
The Unforgettable Fire commentary.
I love this song. Just like Tasula said, I never get tired of hearing this song. And if this is one of those good ones on headphones, I do have to say. I also have a headphones in the dark story about this album. It's a little different. One of the local radio stations was playing anthologies of different bands, and they would start at midnight. So, you know, being a college student, I'm like, oh, I'll just sleep with my headphones on, and I'll get up, and I'll go to class, and it'll be fine, because they were doing U2. So, of course, I wanted to stay up and listen to the whole U2. So they started with the first album, and they worked their way through. So by the time they got to the Unforgettable Fire, it was probably about 4 o'clock in the morning, and I was deliriously tired, and this album came on, and it just, I was having visions, and it was, you know, just all the different sounds, and this song especially was, I can still remember that feeling that I had listening to the song in the headphones while I had been up all night. So, Tasula, I'm with you on this one for sure. It's a great, great song. Yeah.
All right, so let's keep moving. Promenade is the next song. Like I said before on these shows, these episodes anyways, I sort of fall into just listening to the album instead of remembering that we're on a podcast and needing to talk about it.
I had to resist the urge to start singing, so
sorry. Promenade. Matt, do you want to take the lead on this one?
Yeah, this to me, Marilyn mentioned when she was talking about a sort of homecoming that, you know, she mentioned about Bono and his his singing, and I think the poetry of this album. And this to me, this is a, you know, just a poem that is set to music. And this was a time when, and Bono talked about this in a lot of the interviews from that era, where he wasn't, you know, sometimes he was writing words just because of how they sounded, not because of what they meant or said. And I think this is probably a really good example of that, because a lot of it doesn't really make much sense. Some of it does. I mean, some of it, we know the story that the spiral staircase talks about, you know, the house that he and Allie had when they, you know, first got married, that sort of stuff. But a lot of it is just, you know, is just him like sort of sketching different words out and sound. And I just, this song, you know, for me, brings me to a happy, peaceful place the same way Unforgettable Fire does for Tesla. This is one of my favorites.
That's interesting. It's one of those ones for me that's like, it's more like who U240 was saying, U2 War 40 was saying, like, sketches that to me doesn't land as well, but not that it's a hate thing or anything like that. But I guess after the sort of, it's a good like emotional break, I guess, after the well composed and deeper, I guess, Unforgettable Fire, you know, that you've just come through, I guess, in that sense. But yeah, it wouldn't be one of my favorite tracks on the album, but Tesla or Marilyn, how about you?
No, I mean, it's obviously not my favorite, but I probably like it more than you do and less than Matt does.
We have the ranking system. Okay, Marilyn, yeah. Where do you fit in between?
Well, I have to agree with Matt. I think this whole album is exactly what he just said, where there are songs that have very deliberate lyrics, and then there's just like Bono's stream of consciousness songs. So you get a little bit of each of those. And this one falls kind of right in between that. I mean, it sort of means something, but doesn't really mean anything. But I like it. I just like the sound of it. I really like the sound of it.
All right, let's keep moving. We're on to 4th of July.
Yeah, so I think this is, I was just about to fall asleep. It was so hypnotizing.
Hopefully people are still awake listening to the podcast, but yeah.
I got all relaxed. Like, this is one of those, well, the album as a whole is one of those that you could actually like put on to go to sleep to. You can't do that with a lot of U2 albums. Mm-hmm. But I have actually gone to sleep to this album many times. But anyway, 4th of July, why I like it, it's because, to me, it's like an inside joke between fans. Like, since social media has come about, I have begun a tradition of posting this on Twitter or wherever on 4th of July here in America, which is a big Independence Day holiday for us. And all of the U2 fans will retweet it and be like, yeah, you know, everything. And a lot of other people will go, why did you, you know, tweet this out? And I use a version that doesn't have the title, so people don't know that it's called the 4th of July. And they're like, what is this? Why would you be? And they don't realize that it's U2. And, you know, so I think it's fun because it's an instrumental song, which obviously we hadn't seen at this point from the band. And it's not bad. It's something you can put on and like do your laundry. You can put it on if you're reading a book and it's not so distracting that you won't be able to read your book. So a lot of uses for 4th of July.
I would never think of it as a useful song, but I do. I will from now on.
I don't have any particular, you know, comment on the song itself, but I would just like to say that I would love for them to put an instrumental on an upcoming album again. It's been forever since they've done that.
Sure.
Yeah, it's a unique thing, and again,
good at it.
Yeah, it's like from a newer U2 fan or whatever, coming back to this, it's kind of an odd thing to have instrumentals in my mind, but it definitely isn't a bad thing, especially as an album concept. You know, in this day and age, obviously you have singles and songs and you just grab whatever you want and listen to. It kind of gets lost in that idea, but yeah, definitely fits on an album discussion. So, all right, next up is Bad. That one for me.
So let it keep playing. Come on.
I just want to
get sued. It's only 6 minutes long.
Yeah, I was going to say.
Yeah. It's not the live version. That's 8 minutes or whatever.
Can we get the Ruby Tuesday line, please?
Yeah, I know. It's definitely one of those live songs that, like, I'd love to hear how folks who, I came to it knowing it live, and that was, you know, coming back to the album version, then it's like, well, I like the song, obviously, I guess. And so, but I'd love to hear folks who heard it on the album first and how it sort of resonated. Cause for me, it conjures up just the stadium of people at sort of in peace in a sense, but, like a release, emotional connection with the band, with a memory, with a time of life or whatever it happens to be for each person, on that level. But then also just as from a guitar player standpoint, it's such an interesting, simple little melody line that or riff that Edge plays over and over for 6 minutes but they can pull it off. And that's what's always so impressive to me. Plus I love anything where he's doing like what's basically kind of like calling a droning sound where he's got an open string that's just ringing, which the song is full of, and it just makes for a fun thing to try and replicate and play. If you've got your own little echo unit type thing to play along with, on your electric guitar in your basement or wherever you happen to be. So, but, maybe Marilyn, I don't know, if you have a memory of like hearing this song for the first time on the album and not coming from the live performance to the album, and what were your thoughts when you heard it?
I immediately liked the song the first time I heard it, and I think it's like you said, it's just simple, and it's it starts off really slow and quiet, and then it builds and builds and builds, and I think that's one of the things the band is really good at, is building that feeling and then the release, like you said, in the live setting. So I always love this song. And you can sing it like at the top of your lungs and not feel like an idiot. So I like that aspect of it myself.
How about for you, Matt?
I listened to the album, I liked the song, but Chris, I guess I come to it from that other angle that you did, because I wouldn't have said, you know, I didn't see U2 live until April 24th of 85. So the album had been out several months by then, eight months, I think, by then. And I don't recall thinking that Bad was anything special when I would listen to it on the CD. I didn't dislike it in any way, but it wasn't until I saw that live show that I understood what Bad was all about and what it could be. It didn't really take on any special meaning to me until I heard it live. And so, yeah, for that first 6-8 months, it was just another U2 song. And then everything changed.
That's interesting. And then, yeah, famously, obviously, they played it at the Live Aid.
Live Aid.
Yeah, in 85, and did a 12-minute version of it that's, you know, in a lot of people's minds sort of helped catapult them to that some next level or whatever and things like that. So, no question that it's a famous song and well-deserved and doesn't, for whatever reason, like in the same way that I was talking about Pride having, you know, sort of being like, oh, here we go again, kind of feeling for me anyways, it Bad doesn't have that, and yet it's not, I don't think it's played as much. I don't have the numbers in front of me, but it hasn't been played maybe as much, but it's definitely up there in terms of, and a very, you know, similar kind of vibe of like Edge playing a repeating line over and over for a lot of the song. But I think it is like, for me, it's a much more emotional depth that you can, once you've seen them live, obviously you've seen it live, it's feels like Bono is really connecting with something much deeper than just what's happening in front of him when they're singing it. So, any final comments to Sula? Did you have, I sort of cut you off there.
No, Live Aid. I was just going to say, I always liked the song on the album, but I didn't love it until Live Aid.
Yeah. Very cool. Okay. Indian Summer Sky. I don't know if we can listen long enough without getting sued to get the OOs.
Probably not.
For anybody who's wondering, just I guess if you're curious, we have permission to play, you know, a bit of a song, but we can't play very much of it before we set off some lawyer alarm bells or whatever. That's what we keep referring to. So Indian Summer Sky. What do you folks think about? It's definitely a return to aggressive musical styling and sort of, you know, you can picture them picking the song orders and sort of like, okay, after Bad, we want something maybe to bring us back up a bit or whatever. Again, I guess I keep harping back to this idea of how you guys would have heard it, you know, initially or whatever, you older folks, our elders. I'm curious.
For that.
Yeah. Our elders. How did it go back in?
You know, I come on the podcast to get away from my kids telling me how old I am. So I really don't need this.
Same.
Hey, that was it. That's what the kids say today, Marilyn. Same.
That's right. Okay. That's all they say.
Awesome.
They probably don't say awesome though, but anyway, no. What's Indian Summer Sky? Is it a love hate? Where do you guys fall in this one?
Oh, it's there. I don't dislike it at all. It's another sky. I mean, the lyric that we just heard, you let it play until the very first line, in the ocean cuts ring deep the sky. Like, what in the name of God is he talking about? Right.
Bongolese.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's, I don't know. It's another sketch. You know, it's not a bad song. It never had much of a live history. They played it a few times back in the day and you know, no, I don't know anyone that, you know, just jumps and says it's their favorite all time U2 song, but I don't think it's bad in any way.
Yeah. 9 times according to the U2 at U2.com database. So.
There I think go. It would be exhausting for Edge to play. It seems like a lot of guitar work.
Yeah. Well, and Adam too. He's going pretty good on this one. So.
Yeah.
All right. Well, let's not dwell. We'll move on. Elvis Presley in America. That's another, it's an interesting, musically wise, instrumentation wise, I don't know exactly what Edge is using there. It's some sort of acoustic-y shimmering guitar sound that he's got going on that isn't a common sound from the rest of the album anyways. And, kind of lends to the, what was it? I think Marilyn was saying like the ethereal kind of sound of the whole album is there in various ways, but, definitely comes through on that song. But Marilyn, maybe, I don't know if you have thoughts on Elvis Presley in America and,
this is the Bongolese preserved for the ages. So wasn't this the song that they were just sounding out and trying to just playing in the studio, and Eno said, okay, that's it, we're putting it on the album. Is that right, Matt? I thought
yes, that is correct.
Yeah, so like a lot of the other songs, I think this has Eno all over it. I don't know. I mean, I like it and I don't.
Well, this song actually, you know, my experience over the years is that this song is, you know, like fandom is divided on this one. That there's, you know, there's a lot of people that really, really hate it. And then others that, you know, just think that it's this, you know, really cool experimental type thing. And I don't know. I lean towards more that it's really cool just because it's so different. I thought I'd heard that the music, or maybe just the drum track, but maybe the whole music is, it's a sort of homecoming slowed down or something like that, or it's one of the other songs just slowed down. I don't recall if that's correct, but.
Well, the drums are definitely more tribal than military, like the last album, you know, mm-hmm. in this sequence. So there's something there.
Yeah, I didn't know the story of Eno sort of saying, that's it, we're putting it on or whatever. And because it definitely sounds like almost like a rough demo that somehow slipped through in a sense, in terms of just production, whatever. But
I'll just real quick. I know we have a policy against reading on the podcast.
Uh-oh, you're going to piss him off. Don't make the host mad.
But this is what Ian has on this is what Ian has on the lyrics page for Elvis Presley America. This is a quote from Bono in the New Musical Express, 1984. He says, Eno just handed me a microphone and told me to sing over this piece of music that had been slowed down, played backwards, whatever. I said, what, just like that? He said, yes, this is what you're about. So I did it. And when it was finished, there were all these beautiful lines and melodies coming out of it. And they put it on the album just like that.
Hmm. Interesting. Yeah. It kind of makes sense. And yeah, you can, I'll put a link to the lyrics page in case you haven't ever, sort of read along with what he's actually sort of saying and how it is kind of just random Bongolese as we're saying, but still curious to see what comes out of his mouth when he just freeforms it.
I like what Pool Boy just said in the chat room, that it's kind of a glimpse inside the making of a U2 song. That's a good way to put it.
Yeah. 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 Like one that they, a demo that they left. If and when we ever get the vaults released someday and get to sort of see a bit more of a peek into some of the drafts, I guess, that they're left behind, we hear more stuff like that. But all right. Finally, MLK. Sula, do you want to lead off her final song?
Yeah. So this one has really warm memories for me. Years ago, when I was in college in Missouri, I was a preschool teacher, and I would arrive, because of my schedule, I was like the afternoon teacher or whatever. So I would arrive right when the kids who were there all day were laying down for a nap. So I would like tuck them in for their nap, and then I would dim the lights and I would sing to them to put them to sleep. And at the same time, there was another group of students that would always be leaving. The morning kids were leaving. And we had, you know, different stairways and stuff that they went up so they didn't disrupt the children that were about to go to sleep, et cetera, et cetera. And anyway, when I would sing this song to them to go to sleep, which I did quite often, a few times a week at least, I noticed that there would be like a mother that would linger in the corner when I was singing, which was not, it wasn't as creepy as it sounds, but she was lovely. And finally, one of these times, you know, I had them all asleep and I started to go back upstairs to prepare whatever I was going to do when they woke up. And she grabbed me in the hallway and said, "I just have to ask you, you know, that's such a beautiful song that you always sing and the kids always talk about it. And what hymn book is that from? Like, what church were you raised in that has that song?" And I just thought that was such a compliment. I was like, "It's actually not a church song. It's a U2 song."
Church of U2.
And now I'm probably going to not be able to sing it anymore because you're asking me this question. But no, she was just flabbergasted. She's like, and I, you know, she considered herself a fan, quote unquote. You know, she knew a few of their songs, of course, but she's like, "Oh my gosh, I'm going to go buy that CD right now. Like that's just the most beautiful song. And every time that I start to hear you sing it, it like calms me down. I'm coming in off of my part-time job and you know, everything." And I thought, well, gee, that's great. You know, that's really a compliment. And that's how I feel when I hear it. It's certainly, again, it's one of those that just like really calms me down and takes the stress away and the rain and all the good stuff, only makes it better.
Yeah. I'm trying to think, do they have, I'm just, again, I'll blame the cold medication, but a song that is that sort of like just no band Bono singing over top of a, you know, synth or whatever strings for the whole song like that? Is that unique to this album and this song?
Well, if 40 didn't have drums, it would be close to that, but
yeah, but even there,
but there's drums, you know?
Yeah. Anyway, it is an interesting album that way, just in terms of the different ways they experimented. And probably, you know, I would guess, like we alluded to earlier with, you know, Eno sort of saying, "Here's what you're going to do for Elvis Presley." You know, they're probably a little bit intimidated with these two producers and sort of letting them dictate a bit, maybe more than what they would in later on in their career, I guess. I don't know. It's hard to say, but
I do think, while Chris is hacking up his lungs, that I think that the reception of 40 probably allowed them to feel like they could end this album with this song.
Right. And maybe that's like you had brought it up as a possible comparison. That's a good comparison because it does sort of give them freedom to know that their audience and their crowd or whatever will follow them to that, even though they, you know, they love the I Will Follows and things at the time, Pride, etc. But knowing that, right, yeah, a song like this they can get away with maybe or whatever musically too, is kind of interesting. So.
And they kind of kept that trend up. I mean, you know, for later discussions, but think about Love is Blindness. Think about, you know, some of the other songs that have ended the other albums later on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Love is Blindness would be a good comparison, I guess, too. Similar kind of feeling anyways of the production of it. All right. Well, I don't want to keep us going and all of a sudden we'll be at 2 hours. We know how Matt hates the long ones. So, but any closing comments on Unforgettable Fire? We'll go around the virtual roundtable, starting with Marilyn, if you want to go first and sort of each give any sort of closing comments on the album that you maybe didn't get to in the earlier discussion. But go ahead, Marilyn.
Well, I would just like to say that this is the album that really pulled me in to being a U2 fan. I really liked War, and you know, the first two albums I knew just the hits from hearing them on MTV or whatever, but this is the one where I really just got sucked in to this band, and I still love this album. I still think it's an awesome album. I think I love the experimentation on this album and the noise and everything. So yay, you too. Thanks for putting this one out.
Matt, how about you?
I would just say what I said earlier. I would just invite everyone to turn the lights out, put their headphones on or their earbuds in and just play this on repeat a couple times some night and just soak it in and enjoy it. It's so, so good.
Yeah, definitely. I agree. And Tasula, how about you?
Always a favorite. Still in my top five of all time. Love it.
Yeah, and that's what I hope. I'll speak as the token Actung Baby U2 fan here. that through the discussions of these earlier albums, especially that, you know, newer fans find their way back to some of the older albums as a whole, not just as, you know, songs they've heard live or whatever, and give them a spin or a stream wherever you happen to listen to music. If you're near, who is it, Sula or Matt has the, or maybe you both have the actual record still.
Yeah, we both do.
Marilyn too, probably. You can definitely, you can hear stuff on some of the older recordings, and you don't necessarily get to hear. And like Matt said, throwing some headphones on and hearing what's actually going on in the midst of all the noise is a great way to experience the album. So, next coming up next is the Joshua Tree, a fairly popular album among YouTube fans and music fans in general. And I forget who's fighting right now about getting to be on that discussion, but so we'll be back in a couple of weeks with that one. I like what Pool Boy in the chat room had mentioned, that MLK is kind of the obvious sort of drone connection of MLK as the last song of this album into Streets on Joshua Tree is kind of a nice little segue. That's what we'll be discussing in episode 40 of our podcast. But you can find all the links and things we discussed throughout the show. Whenever we've said, it'll be a link in the show notes. If you visit goodstuff.fm/ATU2/39, that's where you can find this episode. You can follow @U2.com on Twitter @U2 and facebook.com/@U2com is where you can follow, like on Facebook. So thanks to Tasula, to Marilyn and Matt for joining me for this discussion and keeping me from going too far off into the cold medication territory and just doing a 3-hour version of Elvis Presley in America of my own. Where can folks find you if they want to give you some comments, I guess, on Twitter, Marilyn? I would start with you.
I'm at Miss Marilyn.
And Tasula?
At Tasula, TASSOULA.
And Matt?
At Matt McGee.
And I'm Chris, and we will see you back again in a couple weeks. And if not then, then hopefully in Cleveland or Dublin, depending on where you end up and where you are in the world. Thank you for listening, and have a great day. Bye.